On Wednesday, August 26th, Senator Jeff Merkley, D-O-R, has indicated that he will support the Iran nuclear agreement, while Senator Wyden appears to be leaning towards a no vote. The Bulgers suggest that listeners call Senator Wyden's Portland office at 503-326-7525 to register their support and ask him to support the deal as well. All right, coming up at 9:30, the topic is digital ageism. The Canadian professor, Kim Sochich, who is currently researching aging and mobile technology and ways to bridge the age divide in communities. That's coming up on KBOO Portland, your community radio, right after this.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, a three-day event from September 11th through 13th. The keynote speaker for this 20th anniversary celebration will be Mr. Les Pee-wee Harrison. And other speakers include Imani Muhammad, Mike Crenshaw, Jamo Greenidge, and more. That's Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, September 11th through 13th, at venues across Portland. Location, speakers, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Today on Wings, Digital Ageism.
The older people have not been able to take their role in society of leading and guiding the young because they haven't had any means to do so.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Globetrotting reporter Rosemarie Whaley recorded the following interview in her own hometown, Montreal, Quebec, Canada.
Kim Sochich is a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at Concordia University. Her research interest involves assisting elders, particularly women, to use technology to improve their lives and that of those around them. Kim, what is digital ageism?
Digital ageism is the idea that a particular kind of age that a human being is means that they have a propensity and a natural inclination to be able to use digital technologies with facility. So, for example, we look at younger children and think about the ways that they touch a computer and think that it's just natural. Or we look at an older person and assume automatically that they have no interest in communications that's mediated. Well, we live in a society where all communication is mediated. Now, when you have a telephone, you're dealing with mediated forms of communication. So you're dealing with technology throughout the life course. So digital ageism assumes that at particular points in your life that you have a greater or lesser facility with particular kinds of technologies. And that's exactly the kind of presuppositions that our research group is examining and also unraveling.
Can you tell us about some of the projects that you've been working on?
One of the first projects that I was working on was called Seniors in Cells. It was an examination of the way that older folks use cellular telephones, as they're known in Canada, but mobile telephones, as they're known in other parts of the world. One of the real important things that we noticed is that if you look at the statistics that are generated by the wireless industry, for example, once you hit 50 or 55, you enter into what we call the gray zone. That is, there is no differentiation made statistically between someone who's 50 and someone who's 90. So what ends up happening is that you have a kind of idea that to be older means that you're absolutely homogenous as a group, and that even before retirement or post-retirement, that somehow your needs and desires aren't shifting and changing, that there's no analysis of what this means in terms of issues of gender, race, or class, et cetera, so that the older adult becomes the senior, becomes a marketing category, has no relationship to life. So what we did is that we also realized that within our field, communication studies, part of the digital ageism is that there was an overemphasis on what youth are doing with media and media technologies, and absolutely no interest in what it might be that this large category, the 50 plus, might be doing with media and communication technologies.
How very, very true that is. I've been doing community radio for years and years and years, and the young people are wonderful at all this mixing on the board, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the older ones who have got so much to say and really no access to ways to say it.
I think part of it is not to sort of say then, well, we then are only looking at older generations. It's also figuring out how things change for us, how we can set up situations where younger folks and older folks have a chance to come into contact with each other on projects, but also to upset the idea in the field of media and communication studies that older adults have nothing to say about communications or about devices, and that we have nothing to learn from them, which is also, I think, a problem, but also I'll give you a good example from how a literature can actually have digital ageism embedded in it. For example, not only statistically, but as well, the way that older adults are often characterized is that they're not innovators. They're seen as somehow lagging behind. So there's this kind of language that automatically assumes that they're late adopters. There's this language that has been set into motion that also doesn't understand that if people refuse to use, it may be for a variety of factors, not because they're incapable, but maybe because they're living on a fixed income and they can't afford every new gizmo. Maybe because they've also seen every promise that every new communication technology that's marketed to them is going to change their lives radically and they don't believe it anymore. Maybe it's also because they're doing things like sharing a device, not just individually owning it. Well, they're not going to show up in the marketing data. But from our point of view, these are really important workarounds for using digital devices. That means that you're not just saying, hey, there's a new phone out there, I'm going to buy it. So we started to look at the idea of non-use or resistant forms of use or ingenious workarounds we found people who were living often on fixed incomes after retirement doing to get access, not as a form of non-adoption or lagging behind, but in fact as something that had to be recognized for what it was, which was often quite innovative as a tactical workaround.
I think also there's another category, and that's just that people do have quite successful social habits. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, we learned to actually calculate. We can calculate in our heads with no calculator. So, of course, there are people that are used to visiting, walking, etc., that don't necessarily instantly think of using these devices.
Well, this is another one of the great myths of technology, is that one technology replaces the other. So that if I start talking on the phone, that I'm going to stop talking to people. That there's a kind of linear progression of technologies that forces you to kind of get rid of your practices. One of the important things we've learned from working with organizations like RECA, for example, Respecting Elders Communities Against Abuse, is that they have very strong social habits and practices. So when we introduced digital technology to them, for example, using a camera for their meetings, instead of just picking up the technology as if it was going to change those habits, what they did was they incorporated the technology so that it adopted itself to their social habits. Example, when we first met RECA and we were giving so-called digital literacy skills and brought the digital camera to the meetings that we had with them, what they insisted on was passing the camera around so that when we would say the greeting, which they had to begin every meeting, you know, how are you? I'm fine. How are you, Ethel? Oh, I'm well, Kim. So they would take turns doing the same ritual but passing the camera so that you were always on both the being on the other side of the image, operating the camera, there was a great reciprocity that was set into motion. So the technology wasn't determining and changing their social habits. It was being used to be able to, in some ways, help us understand how it is that technology doesn't determine everything, but social practices and habits remain vitally important.
There are some other projects that you've been working on.
Well, one of the things that we firmly believe in is that we shouldn't be just studying people and studying older adults and treating them as objects of our research. When we do, we like to pay them as much as some researchers might pay a lawyer and value their time. We think these are really important political questions as researchers and that we have to acknowledge the wisdom and advice that this cohort of people have to give us. But we also are interested in ways that knowledge can be shared, not just by writing a paper, but through creative co-productions and through collaborative forms of research. So one of the ways that we've been approaching digital learning, I suppose some people would call it, would be on a project basis that involves creativity at its core. So for example, with the Atwater Library, they were running digital scanning workshops for older adults who often, again, it was a surprise to us and you learn these things. Digital scanning may not seem like the bleeding edge of technology, but if you've got a whole bunch of family photos, for example, sitting at home, and you've got a bunch of children and grandchildren who may want to have them, and you have only one photo, then one of the workshops that the library could not fulfill was the digital scanning workshops because people were bringing in their family photos. Now, the problem with living in the kind of neoliberal capitalist world we live in is that everything is about innovation. So that for various organizations like RECA or the library or ourselves to be able to get grants, and I'm not being cynical about this, we've been quite successful, you have to pretend that you're being innovative all the time. And so that, sadly, if something works, like the digital scanning of family photographs workshops, for some adults, you know, even paying whatever the minimal fee is too much. So we're always kind of thinking, well, how can we reinvent a context that's a learning context that is creative, that is innovative, and gives those skills? So we did a project with them called Memory Space, in which we gave 32 people free workshops to participate in our project. And then we talked to them about what they were learning and observed how they were learning and what they were doing and invited them to become part of a second part of that project in which we said, let's do a curatorial creative collaboration. People were from all kinds of different backgrounds. Let's think about how our family photographs tell a story about this neighborhood and about your movement into Montreal, and let's construct a project together. So suddenly, we were writing artist statements together, we were doing a little iMovie thing together, they were having to take their individual photographs and put them together, and we made large screens and projected them out the window of the library. It was absolutely beautiful. They decided that it wasn't enough to just have the digital stuff, that they also wanted to bring in artifacts that were relevant to the photographs and to the digitization process. So they set up cabinets with their passports from Expo, their old books, their old cameras they brought in. It was absolutely fabulous. And of course, we like to celebrate events like that. So we had a fabulous vernissage with kids, grandchildren, friends. We had probably 200 to 300 people. And giving people a reason to learn something that is meaningful to them, puts them into a social context, brings out their creativity, is another way of saying digital tools aren't there just for information giving. They're not there just for communicating one-on-one. They're also things that can be repurposed for social moments and events. We learn lots from doing that. We learn, and people who come to these workshops learn that they have the capacity to learn. They also learn about the research process in a different way, and our outputs, so-called, as we have to call them, that are not necessarily papers. They're a collaborative co-production.
It's too bad, in a way, as you say, that we can't get repeated grants for these things.
It's difficult, but there's always ways around it. This is what I learned from working with people over the years, is that you also parse them out, and also you can always tweak them in a way so that if the intention is to create situations of creative collaboration, maybe you give it a new title, and you also build on what you learned and the mistakes you may have made in the first round. So there's always something new to learn where you have to phrase things slightly different. And what I've learned working over the years, I suppose, on these kinds of things is that don't expect to do everything with one project. Don't do too much. Do less and make more with less.
On Wings, you're listening to Rosemary Whalley's interview with communications researcher Kim Sawchuk of Concordia University in Montreal. The topic is digital ageism.
I'll talk to you a little bit about a project that my collaborator at the University of Montreal, Lynn Grenier, is doing that's also evolved into a community project. Her great fascination is on issues of music and aging. What she has initiated as a pilot project with our group is something that's an examination of a phenomena through Chartwell Wright, which is a major housing corporation who sponsors something called Senior Stars in English and Les Étoiles des Aînés in French. And what they are is they're basically like a star academy, and they're fascinating events. They're usually 8 to 10 competitors who get up and perform to an audience of up to 200 people. And we were kind of at first, I have to say, a little bit skeptical and cynical because we thought, you know, really, what's going on? But the kind of deep emotional charge of watching people from all walks of life explain why a song has meaning and listening to an audience suddenly get up and sing. If somebody forgets the words, filling in the words for them, telling the story of where this song comes from, bring a grandchild on stage, you know, somebody who looks demure when they walk on a stage and then opens their mouth and their voice just throws you against the wall. They're fabulous moments for realizing that no matter at all ages, we need to be participating within cultures. The digital world for our network is dealing with three areas: the proliferation of information technology, the creative ways that these technologies can be deployed, but also its connection to culture. So all the projects we do think about what it means to be aging within a digital world from that perspective.
Kim, I know there are people that really are very, very intrigued by the technology, but they're a little bit reticent about this whole issue of privacy and who has access to their information.
They should be reticent. And I think there are often generational differences because there are notions of what constitutes intimacy, which is different than privacy, who's within your so-called circle of friends, understanding what the reach of that technology is, what kind of data mining is going on. But now we have actually fewer and fewer choices about whether we participate or not, because more and more information from governments are going online. Talk about digital exclusion. One of the assumptions, for example, with tablet computing and with other things is that everybody can participate. Well, if you don't have a credit card, you can't. But a credit card is a technology for giving information about your income, where you're located, your purchasing habits. So we are being monitored absolutely everywhere, and there are serious privacy concerns. Again, one of the early studies we did when we first got involved in this is that someone said to us, we're dealing with issues around digital privacy. And our sense was, right away, was to say, well, how do people understand privacy? So they were lawyers who were saying, well, we are trying to train people and give them information about privacy. They're not listening to us. And we're thinking, well, maybe it's because you're not speaking their language. So we did interviews with older adults about how they understand privacy. And that was absolutely fascinating. So again, I think the first step for understanding this is taking seriously people's reticence as real for a reason. And then understanding when they say the word privacy, what is it they're actually meaning and what are they concerned with? Some of the workshops, again, that the Atwater Library and Computer Center is offering is how do you protect your privacy on the internet? What does it mean to be using Facebook? What are the kind of privacy controls that one can put into place? Do they actually protect you? I think people appreciate, for example, something like email because there's a feeling that they know where a message is going to. You post something to a wall on Facebook and you don't know who's going to see what. And so there's been famous cases like the case a few years ago where she was charged with going on a holiday while she was receiving a benefit and because she'd posted something on her Facebook page. So was this an invasion of privacy, or did the company she was working for have the right to be able to take away her benefits because of her violating her disability agreement? So there's lots of reasons to be concerned about the amount of monitoring that's going on. And I think, again, another service that we can offer people is workshops on knowing what is a privacy control, how are they changing, what can I do to protect my financial information, and all the other kinds of scams that are going on, things like phishing, things like fake donation scams, the robocalls that happen that offer everybody a cruise. They get people very excited, and we don't want people to be losing their shirts. And we want people to protect themselves also financially. So I think, again, this is a rapidly changing world that we assume that everybody knows about. It's not just seniors who need this information. It's everybody who needs workshops on what privacy within a digital era is and how do I deal with it. What's a normal expectation? And should I be using online services for purchasing, etc.? I think being informed is really, really important. But I have to say that all of us are always feeling like we're catching up because the rules are constantly changing and we don't have the resources that corporations have to be able to do this kind of work. So we're kind of scrambling. So if people choose to be reticent about use, again, I think that's a really important acknowledgement of wisdom.
One of our responses to ageism, of course, is to really guard our independence. We really jealously guard our independence. And I think it's very hard for us to realise that we're totally helpless in terms of who's going to have our information or who's going to have the history of our thoughts because we've been looking things up on Google, etc.
That's true. But, you know, I'm not quite sure what to respond other than to say that there's a question of autonomy and agency. And I think all of our work is guided by the idea of the purely autonomous individual is a patriarchal fiction to a large extent, and that we are relationally interdependent. That's one thing. But that doesn't mean that interdependence means getting rid of notions of agency. I want to still feel like I can be an actor and a contributor to the world. And so I think it's a fine line that we're kind of treading here, but that it's important to acknowledge that. So again, I think our sense is that, you know, dealing with digital ageism is not saying everybody has to be online. It's saying everybody has the capacity to make an informed decision about what their needs and desires are, about how much they want to engage or not.
Where does your work go from here?
Well, I'm delighted to say that I love my job. I love my students. I love my communities I work with. And also, we are working with more and more international partners. We always felt like we were a small group of people actually interested in this kind of intersection between age and technology. Where our work goes from here is, I think, also an intervention in terms of gerontology. Because, to be quite frank, when I look at all the gerontology literature and I've looked at it, there is nothing on communication, nothing on technology. There's an assumption that once you become 60 or 70, that you enter into the beige zone, not just the gray zone, and you're disinterested in what's going on in the world around you. And honestly, what we did, one of the most amazing research experiences I had was when we did interviews with people in a residency in Toronto, where the average age of our respondents was 92. And they, it's not just, I mean, some of them had cognitive difficulties, but at moments, and some of them didn't. We decided, let's just talk to them all. Many of them, even if they didn't own a device, were interested and implicated in the world around them because their kids, their grandkids had, you know, cell phones and computers and would bring them onto Skype. So our work is going into the realm of taking account the old, but also saying that, listen, you know, the gerontology literature treats all technology as if it's only for assistance, for physical assistance, as if it's for a failing body. And there's many reasons people want to learn a technology. Communication is really important to people. Residencies, for example, will have to be wired in the future because people will have that expectation. There's incredible amounts of isolation in these homes because people may not be able to afford a telephone. Maybe they want to Skype. Maybe they want to play games. Maybe they want to talk to their children. Well, are we facilitating these kinds of experiences that can make people feel a part, as if they're still a part of the world around them, no matter what age they are, because we also have to understand that these devices have incredible symbolic power for people. If you don't feel like you know what's going on or have the chance to ask questions about it, you're made to feel completely dissociated and left out. So we have lots of pilot projects that we do because we like starting very small and learning to ask the right questions and not spending lots of money on things that aren't going to work, and then figuring out bit by bit what can work. So one of the projects is to develop mobile kits that we can take to residences and offer the kinds of workshops we do to people who maybe are mobilized but have an interest. Yeah, see what happens if we did projects like we've done at the Atwater Library, where people don't have to come there. It's still assuming they're physically mobile. Maybe they're cognitively capable and physically incapable. Well, let's bring a project to them. But also we're working more and more internationally because conditions aren't the same in all areas of the world. So that's another exciting part for me for what we're doing, is understanding what does it mean to be living in North America, in Quebec, at this moment, etc., dealing with these issues.
When you say you're working internationally, can you describe one of the contexts?
We've worked with people in Catalan and Barcelona for many years now, three or four. In England, the Dutch situation isn't the same as the Romanian situation. So we're working internationally on those realms. We do have some contacts and connections with some people in Africa. But again, it's starting slowly with people you know. And I'll just talk a little bit about the work of Roxana Berantes, for example, who's in Peru, who works in the context of families having to sustain themselves through using cellular phones to run small businesses. There's not the same kind of social welfare systems as we have, knock on wood for the minute here. And so her work is driven by the idea of the role of the grandparent, for example, in that family and kinship structure in relationship to the microeconomies of families surviving to get their goods from rural areas into local markets. Looking at those microeconomics, but also the role that technologies play in that. People like Joseph Blatt, who's a collaborator in Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona, he does work where he's developing games with older adults. And again, the situation in Catalonia and in Spain is different because of the Spanish Civil War. So you have generations of people who did not necessarily have education, often autodidact, people who are self-taught. Again, education is not to be associated with intelligence, but they have circumstances that are quite different as a result of the war having been in their territory and infrastructures and social structures having been destroyed. So he's been working, developing both games and digital storytelling with older adults. And again, all of our perspective is always, let's not look at what we can't do, let's look at what we can do. And Wendy Martin has done working with a group called BIAS in the Brunel Institute for Aging Studies. She works with a group called the Borg, which are the Brunel Older Researcher Group, and they're the consultants of older adults. They've done all kinds of interesting projects that involve digital photography in everyday life and working class people. These are the international researchers we're working with and the international connections we're making, and they're pretty fabulous.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting because it sounds as though what you're doing is you are filling in that cultural gap, that lag that we've had for the last, say, 20 years, whereby the older people have not been able to take their role in society of leading and guiding the young because they haven't had any means to do so. And so now with this digital stuff that you're talking about, this means that we as older people can go to where the young are and we can assume our traditional roles.
Well, I think it's important because I think we need for younger generations, myself, but my grandchildren, my kids, models where aging is not to be feared. So again, I think our work at its core is really to say, this is a problem for younger people because who would want to grow old if growing old meant that you were put in a corner and dismissed as irrelevant? So how can we reinstantiate and create that dialogue that I think is healthy for a society? And I've worked in daycare centers, and one of the things I've noticed over the years, and I think partially this is the way that marketing works, is that we live incredibly in age-segregated societies. And so how do we deal with this kind of age segregation that is deeply embedded, and what's the role that digital technology has played in solidifying that, but what role can it also play in completely undermining it?
If people want to know more about your work, I'm assuming you have a website.
We do. You can go to www.a-c-m.ca and you will see a full list of our projects, participants. We're always trying to keep up, but nobody can ever keep up. This is not just something that happens as you get older. There's just, you know, as I used to say, cyberspace is just another room to clean.
Kim Sawchuk is a communications professor at Concordia University in Montreal, currently researching aging and mobile technology. She talked about her research with Rosemary Whalley from the Matrix Collective of CINQ-FM. The editor was Laura Yaros. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And please check our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose new book is titled The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
And this is KBOO Portland, where the time is 9:59 a.m. Coming up at 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear flashpoints. U.S.-backed counterinsurgency forces in the Philippines murder three key leaders and educators from the radical opposition. Also, a report from Nepal still devastated from the massive earthquake that rocked that country in April. At 11, Intersections Radio looks at underrepresented voices from minorities in India. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Don Merrill interviews legendary mystery author Sue Grafton about her newest book, X. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support of community radio. For those who are not yet a member of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Simply click where it says Donate Today. And now, flashpoints.